So as mentioned, Dr. Bradley Freeman, also from Washington University in St. Louis, will present to us evaluation and determination of the need for an emergency airway and alternatives to tracheostomies. Thank you, Dr. Freeman.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Jerry, and thank you again for the opportunity to speak. And tracheostomy has been a long-term interest of myself and our group, and we've done a lot of research that I'll try to present a fraction of here, but specifically like what I would like to cover and complement a little bit of what Jerry covered was, number one, why do we perform a tracheostomy? Number two, and this would seem like a very simple thing, but it becomes more complex, is what, in fact, is a difficult airway? And then number three, what tools do we have at our disposal, whether a trauma surgeon or intensivist or an emergency care physician, for innovation? And then finally, how do we adapt information as to how we approach a potential difficult airway to the emergency setting? And in terms of disclosure, I have no relevant financial interest which would impact the content of this presentation. I'd like to compliment a little bit about what Jerry said vis-a-vis the history of tracheostomy as it pertains to the care of the critically ill patient. Jerry went through a very elegant, long history going back several centuries, but I wanted to focus on something that he talked about briefly, and that was the polio epidemic which hit Denmark in 1952. And what I've illustrated on that slide is the need to provide respiratory support for a very large number of patients in the population. And one of the significant aspects of both that epidemic and its aftermath was that it was really the forerunner of the concept of ICUs. That is, it brought to the fore the need that we have to regionalize services within a hospital so that we can care for patients who are critically ill in a coordinated and organized fashion. It turned out that ICUs became organized in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Many people felt as a direct result of this Denmark polio epidemic. The other thing I illustrate on that slide is while we think about tracheostomy again as being very old, and maybe Alexander the Great in fact did perform an emergency tracheostomy in addition to all his other accomplishments, they were using tracheostomies in the polio Denmark polio epidemic. And so from the beginning of ICU care, we have been dealing with tracheostomies and using it as a tool to enable long-term mechanical ventilation. I put on the left-hand part of this slide typical indications for tracheostomy. And again, Jerry covered much of this. And if we think about why most tracheostomies are performed, and this comes up from our own data as well as data from others, it is to enable mechanical ventilation. There's a number of reasons that tracheostomy may do that, and I won't go into all those in details, but number one, relative to a translaryngeal intubation, tracheostomy is more comfortable. We know from a large amount of data now that tracheostomy patients require less sedation than patients with translaryngeal airway. There's a compelling evidence that tracheostomy can facilitate and enable pulmonary toilet. There's equivocal evidence that relative to translaryngeal intubation, tracheostomy results in less work of breathing. We know that tracheostomy patients, by virtue of the fact that they have a more secure airway, are more mobile, so nurses can get them out of bed to a chair and even ambulate them around the unit. And finally, we know that tracheostomy, for many people, promotes a more aggressive style of weaning from mechanical ventilation, again, probably related to the fact that a tracheostomy is a very secure airway. But if you look at the way tracheostomy is practiced, not only in this country, but most industrialized countries, and that constitutes the most the major indications for doing tracheostomy. However, what we're talking about today is tracheostomy for another indication, and that relates to patients that have a difficult airway or patients where you're concerned about airway security. That is, if they have an injured trachea tube that becomes dislodged, it would be very difficult to reestablish it. So what is a difficult airway? And you would think that that is a relatively simple thing to define, but in fact, it's not well defined in the literature. And the definition I've put up here on the right-hand portion of the slide is abstracted from a position statement published by the American Society of Anesthesiology. And it's a very practical and pragmatic approach to the difficult airway. It basically says is a clinical situation in which a well-trained clinician experiences difficulty with face mask ventilation of the upper airway, tracheal intubation, or both. The difficult airway represents a complex interaction between patient factors, the clinical setting, and the skills of the practitioner. And inherent in this definition, there's at least six factors when we think about approaching a patient where we're going to perform, say, tracheal intubation. Number one, we want to know, is the patient cooperative or not? And that might be less of an issue when we're talking about the emergency setting. Number two, can we do a bag mask ventilation? Number three, can we establish a supraglottic airway? Number four, is the anatomy favorable for effective laryngoscopy? Number five, if we can do laryngoscopy, can we actually intubate the trachea with an endotracheal tube? And number six, failing all that, is a patient suitable anatomy for a tracheostomy? And what I've illustrated on the left-hand corner of the slide is a patient certainly would probably have a difficult airway, but would probably also be a very difficult tracheostomy. So many times, these two problems coexist. Now, there's a lot of ways that we approach and further try to quantify what a difficult airway is, and I've put on here a graphic illustration of the Mallampati Index, and we know that anesthesiologists spend a lot of time doing such assessments and doing excellent due diligence to go through the anesthetic record, and patients have had prior anesthetic events to understand if were there problems in establishing a translaryngeal airway. But that all changes when we try to extrapolate this definition to the emergency setting. So number one, the patients we deal with might be very different. So the trauma patients with maxillofacial or tracheal trauma are very different than somebody who you're seeing in the clinic that you might be doing an elective hernia repair on. In addition, there are a lot of other factors that might come into play comparing the emergency to the elective setting. So number one, I spoke a minute ago about the various systems we have to say grade airways, such as the Mallampati system. And that speaks to the fact that generally, if you're dealing with a difficult airway situation, you have time in the elective setting to go through and do a methodical approach. That might not be the case when you're dealing with somebody with the trauma or an emergency setting. Number two relates to the actual time you have to establish the airway. Again, the elective setting, you can do it in a very controlled fashion, the light of day. In the emergency setting, not so much. You have to do things in a very time pressure and time sensitive manner. And then number three, the personnel that you can bring to bear to the situation. So again, in the elective setting, you have the time to have the appropriate personnel, you have the time to recruit the appropriate backup personnel, and you can make sure that you have all the appropriate instrumentation. Again, that might not be the case when you're dealing with something in the emergency department on a 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning. So there are some limitations in extrapolating how we think about and what's written about the difficult airway to the emergency setting. I was somewhat struck when Mike started out the session by asking how many people have, number one, done an emergency tracheostomy or cricothyrotomy during the course of their career, and number two, have done one in the last year. And I think that's a very accurate and good sampling of probably emergency tracheostomy and cricothyrotomy today. I will say in my own practice, and I practice at Barnes Hospital, which is an urban level one trauma center, the number of emergency tracheostomies I have done over the years has diminished dramatically. And I think that is the result of the devices and the innovations I've tried to present on this slide. And I would say in the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, a lot of innovations have come online to allow clinicians to deal with the difficult airway. So what I've shown in the center is something that we've done for a long time, and that is a Waker fiber optic innovation that's been around literally for decades. But many of these other devices are relatively new. What I've shown in the right upper hand corner of the slide is a videoscopic laryngoscope, and we use that quite frequently in our institution, particularly because it is a training institution. In my own mind, that is a real game changer when you're teaching someone how to intubate, meaning that the instructor and the trainee and potentially everybody in the room can look at the visualization and provide feedback and critique to the learner. So I think that that has been a real boon for teaching, but also it appears to be a boon for dealing with the difficult airway. Other devices that have come online, I have on here a laryngeal mask airway. A laryngeal mask airway is nothing particularly new. They've likewise been around for decades, but there's been a lot of, again, refinement and innovation such that you have intubating laryngeal mask airways. You can instrument them now with laryngoscopes and video monitors, and again have created a hybrid instrument which is very useful in experienced hands. The third thing I've illustrated is various types of intubating stylets, and what I've put on the right-hand corner of the slide is something that's very simple, I don't want to say crude, but fairly simple, maybe elegant in its simplicity, but it's an intubating stylet. Like many things, now those have been interfaced with either videoscopic monitors or fiber optic monitors to really expand the repertoire of somebody dealing with a patient with a difficult airway. So how do you put all this together in the patient that you're confronted with in the emergency setting? And again, this is an algorithm that I've adapted from the American Society of Anesthesiology, the citation I've listed there, and the citation speaks and specifically deals with patients in the elective setting, and I've tried to adapt that to how we might think about it in the emergency setting. So I would say, number one, when you're approaching a patient that may have a difficult airway, there are obviously going to be patients that it's going to be unfeasible to try to do a translaryngeal airway, and one would go, as I've shown on this slide, immediately to a surgical airway. So there's obviously going to be patients where it's not feasible, it's not appropriate to do or attempt a translaryngeal airway. But if you factor those out, the next step would be going through those five or six steps I spoke of previously. Can I do face mask ventilation? And if I can't do face mask ventilation, the next step would be to default to, say, a supraglottic airway or an LMA. If that provides an adequate airway, then I would proceed to establishing a translaryngeal airway by either using intubating LMA or one of the other strategies in the box on the left-hand corner of the slide. Obviously, if a supraglottic airway is not successful, you would default to a surgical airway. Taking the other side of this slide, if I can do face mask ventilation, it's adequate, and then I can almost convert it to a semi-elective approach. I can use all the other tools that I have at my disposal to provide translaryngeal airway, whether it's a videoscopic assisted laryngoscopy or using an intubated stylet or maybe using even an intubating LMA, but there's a lot of things and tools at our disposal now to allow us to deal with that situation. Obviously, if that's not successful, once again, we would default to a surgical airway. So in conclusion for my segment of this presentation, I think there are settings where a surgical airway is unequivocally indicated. And as I've shown on that diagram, if there's patients that you either can't bag mask ventilate or can't use a supraglottic airway or anatomically can't even get to that part of the algorithm, one would default immediately to a surgical airway. I do think refinements in both approaches as well as our implementation have probably rendered emergency surgical airway in many settings less common. And so I do think as clinicians, we are doing those less frequently. I do think that has some implication for how we train individuals to do that when you need to do them, and also possibly for maintaining competency, whether there should be simulation or other types of drills that we should do to maintain our competency in that respect is something that we potentially could explore. And I do think for a large number of these patients, we're somewhat delaying the inevitable, meaning what we are changing from somebody who might need an emergency surgical airway to doing an elective tracheostomy. And I don't think that's necessarily bad, meaning that I think that many of these patients would be a potentially difficult tracheostomy. They might need refinements in a typical tracheostomy, but allows us to do it in a more controlled and stable fashion. So those are my comments, and thank you for indulging my interest.